Hey everybody, Stephen Molyneux from Freedom Maine. Hope you're doing well. These are questions from listeners on X. Why do humans hate natural selection? It is clearly the most obvious structure of the designer. So in the Christian worldview, all human beings are created by God, and therefore the soul is common to all human beings, and therefore any differences in group outcomes like sex or ethnicity or other things, all differences in group outcomes must be the result of bigotry. This is where Christianity and the hard left share the same perspective. Now, of course, we're all human beings. We should all be equal under the law. Nobody should have special privileges or disadvantages or anything like that. But in general, in egalitarian ideals, everybody should end up about the same because, you know, we're all made in the image of God and everybody's kind of about the same. And of course, in the left, one of the weapons of the left is to say any and all differences in group outcomes must be the result of bigotry. Like if women make different choices than men, and of course, you can only get equality in income for women if we give up actually having children, because someone's got to take care of the children, and it's mostly women who do that. I worked in a daycare. I kind of saw that firsthand. So for Christians, the idea of differences in group outcomes is offensive because we're all made in the image of God, and therefore we all have souls, and therefore we should all end up at roughly about the same place. And for hard leftists, they say, well, all differences in group outcomes must be the result of racism, sexism, bigotry, some sort of phobia, hostility, hatred, and so on. And therefore, people don't like evolution and natural selection for Christians, of course, because it bypasses God creating and shaping the species. And for leftists, the idea that, let's just say, men and women have evolved to have different preferences, different skills. Again, on average, you don't judge individuals by group averages. But the idea that, like, if you've ever been around truly, truly, truly remarkable people, I mean, the geniuses, this was even the case of coding. Like, I was a manager in the software field. I was chief technical officer and director of technology, and then became chief marketing officer because I was good at the chitty chat as well as the tech. But when you have an average programmer, and then you have a really good programmer, like the really good programmer isn't like 50% more effective and efficient. A really good programmer can be 10 to 20 times more efficient. And in some ways, there's no scale. Like there's no scale that makes sense. Because it's not like an average programmer completes a task in 8 hours, but a really great programmer can do it in an hour. So it's like 8 times faster. The really great programmer will solve problems you don't even know exist, will get so deep into code and work all weekend and create things that the regular programmer simply can't create. Like if you've been around really, really talented and brilliant and motivated people, they operate on a completely different level. The brains feel almost completely different. And again, I know everyone's a person, everyone's equal under the law. I get all of that. But the only way we progress in society is taking the shackles off the most talented and letting them do their amazing thing, or the amazing things. And it is offensive to people. And I kind of understand that. I remember reading a novel many years ago about a guy. He went to a concert and there was, you know, the singer was up on stage doing his thing. And, you know, everyone in the audience wanted to be that singer, wanted to be that guy up there, you know, commanding the crowd, leaping around, singing away. And having people cheer and clap and body surf and all that. Everybody wants to be that guy. I mean, it's hard to look at something like, the famous Live Aid with Queen, you know, Freddie Mercury doing his Benito Mussolini with the crowd. It's kind of hard not to say, well, that'd be kind of cool. And wouldn't that be fun? And wouldn't that be an exciting way to spend your life? So there is, you know, and then you kind of get up and you plod along and you go to your job and you think about, you know, these rock stars and so on. They're partying and sitting on yachts, bikinis and all of that. So there is a certain resentment that people have towards those who are truly skilled. Now, the fact that the truly skilled people live some pretty grim lives fairly often, you know, they don't find a lot of love. They're kind of lonely. They're very isolated from the general patterns of humanity and so on. There's downsides. I get all of that. But, you know, it looks kind of cool. So the fact that evolution has a real scattershot and abilities are wildly distributed among various people. I mean, some people are great at, you know, some men are just great at talking to and picking up women, and other men are very shy. Some people, what did they say? Was it Chris Hemsworth or something like that? It's like, he's very funny. He can sing. I think someone said that about Viggo Mortensen, the guy who played Aragorn. Like, he can ride horses. He can teach you how to fish. He can sing. He can play instruments. He can just do anything and everything. It's amazing. It's amazing. And some people are just now, of course, in the Christian world, they say, you know, God gave you a lot of gifts. And it's like, but if God gives some people a lot of gifts, isn't that playing favorites? Isn't that kind of not everyone being made in the image of God? Because God obviously has tons of gifts, all of the gifts. So people don't like natural selection. It really messes with the left, and it really messes with religion and the hammer, like you hammer down the nail that sticks up, the tall poppies get cut down. The idea that if you know, it's a great line from the original Superman, well, one of the original Supermans, the one with Christopher Reeve, where he runs home super quickly and beats the people who are driving. And his son says, kind of showing off a little there, aren't you, son? And he says, is a bird showing off when it flies? The resentment of the average towards the extraordinary is really something. This is the whole tax the rich even more. Like the rich pay the vast majority of taxes anyway, but it's never enough, right? Resentment. We all want to be at the top of the pyramid. Most of us don't have the talent to get there. And even if we had the talent, we may not have that single-minded dedication it takes to get to the top. You know, Queen was one of the, like, it's a Queen, Rolling Stones, Beatles, you know, like AC/DC, like the top bands. I mean, I don't know the history of the other bands that much, but I know that 10 years into their career, and, you know, the Queen guys had options. Like, Freddie Mercury was studying graphics design, could have made his living doing that. The bassist, John Deacon, was studying to be an electrical engineer. That's a pretty solid career. And Brian May, the guitarist, he was like an astrophysicist working on his doctorate. He then later finished it. And I think the drummer, I don't even know why I know this. I'm not proud that I do, but I do. The drummer, Roger Taylor, was studying to be a dentist. So they all had these options. And, you know, 10 years into their career, you know, Freddie Mercury was living in an apartment with mold on the walls, like some dingy little apartment with mold on the walls. They were endlessly schlepping themselves to gigs, and they were broke. And this is where the song Death on Two Legs comes from, is the ferocity about everyone in the music industry just basically gets ripped off. It's horrendous what happens. So, you know, how many people are willing to sit in there for 10 years when they have other options and just really pursue it and keep doing it and ferociously keep writing and keep recording and touring? Like, Queen never made any money on their tours. They just really enjoyed touring and really loved going out there. And how many people are willing to give up that kind of stable life? You know, so yeah, people don't like the extraordinary. And I understand that. I mean, I think come on, if you're honest, everyone's gone through that resentment of, why him and not me? Why him and not me? I wanted this girl and this other guy got the girl. Why him and not me? Why him and not me? And so natural selection, there's a wide variety of talents and abilities in the world. Some of these are group averages. Of course, some of these are just individual. And, you know, it's like Marvin Gaye, a fantastic singer, right? Wouldn't you? But, you know, his life ended in a horrific way, as did Freddie Mercury's, of course. So people dislike, and we should be taught this, right? We should be taught to embrace the people who are fantastic at what they do. You should embrace and enjoy and appreciate the people who are fantastic at what they do. We wouldn't have art, culture, movies, music, novels, like plays. We wouldn't have these. We wouldn't have these things without the extraordinary. And we can all be envious of the extraordinary, for sure, for sure. And like, I went to see a musical, two musicals not too long ago. And The people who can just like open their mouths, command an audience, sing with passion, with character. Like there was this woman, one of the plays was Guys and Dolls, which I've never seen before. It's set in like the late 40s. And it's very sort of gumshoe. Look here, mate. Not mate, sorry, that's British. See, that's why I'm not on stage doing that stuff. And, you know, they can just open their mouths. They can sing beautifully. They can do characters. They can dance, you know, sing, dance, and act, right? The triple threat. And they just, you know, they put a lot of work into it. They're very talented. They seem to be having a great time up there. And, you know, the audience outnumbers like 20 to 1. And, you know, how many people wouldn't like to be up there singing away and dancing? And that would be fun, but it's not my thing, not my thing, but people do it. So, yeah, just enjoy that people are fantastic. And you know, work to expand your own talents where possible, but we should teach that. The extraordinary should be celebrated, and also it's natural to feel some exclusion and resentment. Exclusion and resentment. That's natural. All right, treating the institution of marriage as a sort of clown car with way too many no longer strictly related to the idea underlying concepts crammed in. Wow, that's quite a sentence. How would you strip it down to its bare minimum? So I can do this one very briefly. The institution of marriage, why did it evolve? The institution of marriage evolved to create a secure pair bond so that children have a great environment to grow up in. Because children learn to love, not just by being loved, by watching their parents love each other. And they learn how to negotiate by watching their parents negotiate. They learn how to have fun as an adult with their own partner by watching their parents have fun together as partners and enjoy each other's company and so on. So marriage is when you get together and you say, we're together forever and we're going to have our kids. Right? We're going to be together, we're going to have our kids. And it's a public declaration that if we drift apart, the family gets us back together. Like the family, the community, everyone's going to say, get back together, you got to work it out. Like if you go on a couple of dates and it doesn't, you know, you don't vibe, you don't click, there's no particular good conversation. There could be mismatches in a variety of values or intelligence levels because people sort relentlessly by intelligence. Like couples are close in intelligence, one of the most replicated findings. You if you're smart, you cannot be with somebody of average or below average intelligence for a lifetime because marriage is just a lengthy conversation. And you can't spend your entire time listening to somebody drone on about the Kardashians and not lose your mind. So if you go out for a little while, there's no marriage in the public declaration, then if you break up, people are like, okay, well, fair call. I'm sorry it didn't work out and so on. But once you declare that you're going to marry together forever, the community, if you start to drift apart or if you say I want out, they sit down, help you work it out and keep you together. So it's a public declaration of saying, this is my commitment, and the community, the family, the extended family, they need to hold me to my commitment. That's what marriage is. All right. Next. Oh, listened to your Sunday morning chat. You stated most people are not virtuous. They're vapid and essentially non-thinking individualistically. I'm a believer in anarchism and agree with you, most people are this way, but wouldn't this make anarchy not likely? I'm starting to think most people want to be slaves. Well, you wouldn't want to study a bunch of animals in a zoo and think that you've learned anything about the nature of animals, right? I am not centered. Oh, how appalling. So if you study people in prison, then you wouldn't learn much about human nature. You would simply learn about human nature in a prison, right? So studying people in the slave planet, in the prison planet, that's a Alex Jones thing, it doesn't teach you much about human nature. I mean, if all you studied were slaves in sort of ancient Greece or Rome or the antebellum South or whatever, if all you studied were slaves and you pretended that there weren't any other kinds of people, that the only people you had access to for some reason were slaves, you'd say, oh, geez, human beings seem to be kind of demotivated. They seem to be kind of resentful and angry. They shirk. They, you know, they're, quote, lazy, because slaves are demotivated because they're ordered around, right? So you wouldn't know much about human nature. You would only know human nature in the institution of slavery. In the same way, if all you studied were arranged marriages, you would say, gee, that doesn't seem to be a lot of wooing or romance or playfulness or affection or charisma in the dating market and so on. And the women seem kind of depressed and the men seem kind of resentful. So you wouldn't know the nature of dating in a free society. All you would know is how people behave when they're encased, enslaved, encaged, forced, subjugated, and ruled over. So when I say most people are amoral at best, I mean, that's just a fact, like at the moment, right? So, I mean, the Milgram experiments, the prison experiments, and so on, 80% of people just do what they're told. And 80% of people, this is why it wasn't too shocking that 80% of people lined up to take a vaccine, because like they'll just do what they're told. And I don't know what that's like. I can't stand, I don't mind doing what I'm told if I respect the authority. If my dentist says, oh, you need to floss the back more, it's like, okay, I'll floss the back more. But I can't really imagine what it's like to not just be amoral, but to lie to yourself about it, right? Because the most important thing in life is not to lie to yourself, not to lie to yourself. To thine own self be true, and then it shall follow as night follows day, thou canst not be false to any man. So you have to be honest with yourself. You have to have an accurate assessment of yourself. You have to be honest with your own capacity for evil and weakness and pettiness and vengefulness and all of the, you know, scrappy but sometimes negative impulses that we have. As I said in my show last night, the people I'm always the most alarmed of are the people who never imagined that they could be the bad guys. Because then what they do is they project all of their potential for badness on other people, right? This is the left saying that, you know, all the people on the right are Nazis and so on, or women who they've studied this. Men have more sympathy and empathy for their political opponents than women have for their political allies. And so the people who've never looked in the mirror and said, could I be a bad guy? I could be a bad guy. I mean, I've certainly thought of that, and I still check myself on that. So, yeah, you have to really be honest with yourself, and most people don't. And the consequence of being amoral or immoral, of just being having the slave mentality, is that you have to lie to yourself and pretend that you're not a slave. You have to lie to yourself and say, no, I'm a good guy. No, I'm I'm not just doing what I'm told. I'm doing the right people. I'm protecting Granny from the Wuhan planet sneeze. And so on. And so just did that lying to yourself. And then once people can get you to lie to yourself, I mean, you're lost to virtue, because all you do is you say, not I'm a good person. You simply readjust your fearful, obedient impulses to be the good, right? So rather than saying, well, there are standards of virtue and value that I should pursue that are going to cause friction and tension and stress and problems in my life and others, what you do is you simply obey, and then you redefine obedience as virtue, right? It's not like, well, I'm just doing what I'm told. You say, well, I'm doing the right thing. And the right thing always happens to coincide with what you're told. So virtue comes with friction. Like, you can't diet without being uncomfortable. And if people just eat whatever they want and call it a good diet, then they'll never change their diet. So the key thing is, and I don't know what makes people want to lie to themselves. I don't, other than, I mean, I guess it's easier, right? It's easier. It's easier to just obey authority and call yourself virtuous than it is to actually be virtuous. Sure. I don't know, maybe people are just lazy, or maybe they're just kind of broken early, or whatever it is. So you don't want to look at humanity at the moment and say, that's human nature. No, that's human nature in a situation where children are abandoned, neglected, spanked, circumcised, brutalized, propagandized, threatened, and just horrible things happen to them all the way through the end of college, like almost a quarter century straight, being dumped in daycares, being yelled at, being called names, being neglected and being ignored, and then being put in terrible schools where they're told that they have the original sin of skin color, especially if they're white, and the original sin of testicles if they're male. And, you know, you're just constant assault on self-esteem, happiness, virtue, independent thought. And they are punished for thinking for themselves, and they are rewarded for nodding along with the woke teacher with the shaved side of the head and all of that. So, and then they go to university, it just continues. So we don't know what people are like in a state of freedom. I mean, if you have been around well-raised kids, particularly homeschool kids, I mean, they're very different from the other kids, right? The other kids are generally hedonists, and they get involved in sex too early. They have a lot of, they do a lot of drinking. They do some drugs. They just kind of amoral pleasure seekers because they haven't been taught any virtues and values. But you know, the kids who are raised well, they're very different. So people respond to incentives, and we are significantly shaped by our environment. So, like, if you were to look and say, well, we can't have a free market. Like, you look at a slave economy, right? And you say, well, we can't have a free market because workers are just too unmotivated. They wouldn't do anything. It's like, but once you have a free market, over time, the workers become more motivated, right? Because they get more reward and they can move up and they get paid depending on how hard they work. So don't mistake the sort of hangdog, slope-shouldered, stare-at-the-sidewalk, shuffle, prison gate of the current humanity and say, well, that's how people would be in a free society. So, of course, you know the dominoes. We raise children peacefully. We raise children rationally. We raise children reasonably, peacefulparenting.com. And then what we do is we end up with people who are self-sufficient, confident, and don't need to be bullied in order to do the right thing, right? We teach morals in the same way we teach a language, and we teach the children that they're worthy of respect by not using aggression or violence against them, calling them names, neglecting them. You know, we love our children. And then they grow up confident and healthy, and the number of criminals will decrease, the number of power-hungry power mongers will decrease, the number of people who will just automatically submit to the power of the state because they submitted to the power of and violence of their parents will diminish. That's how we do it. So I completely understand where you're coming from. I really sympathize where you're coming from. But life after freedom reshapes humanity to the point where, I mean, they will look back upon how we live with absolute horror in the same way that we look back on how slaves lived with absolute horror. So, all right. Is there any validity to the concept of a just war? What are the requirements? So a just war would be a geographical military action to prevent reasonably imminent invasion. So it's the same principle with self-defense. So there's a number of standards that have to be passed morally or philosophically, and I'm not talking legally, I'm not a lawyer, but morally and philosophically, there's a number of standards that would have to be passed in order for self-defense to be valid, right? So generally, you have to be in a situation that you did not necessarily immediately provoke, where you have a reasonable belief that you're about to suffer imminent, grievous bodily harm or death, right? So, you know, somebody flicks your earlobe, you don't get to blow them away because that's not grievous bodily harm. And so you have to be in a situation where you reasonably expect, right? You can't say, well, he looked at me funny and he had a bulge in his pocket, so I figured he was about to shoot me, right? So you have to be in a situation where you have a reasonable belief of imminent bodily harm or death, and then you can use force in self-defense, and you can use a force so that you disable the threat. That doesn't necessarily mean killing someone, although it might, but you use force to disable the threat, right? So if somebody has their arm back and they're about to hit you, then you can hit them first, right? And then once you've hit them, if you've knocked them out, you don't get to shoot them because you've disabled the threat, right? So the same principle would work in a geographical region, like a place, I'd say a country, although this would be in a stateless society going forward. So if you have a reasonable belief that a foreign power is about to inflict some sort of attack upon you, then you would have the right to disable that attack. In general, I would advocate targeting the leaders, and I write about this in my book, The Future. I would advocate targeting the leaders more than the population as a whole. And so that would be a just war, right? That you have a reasonable belief that an attack is close. And prior to that, you would try and reduce the threat through diplomacy. But once, you know, once the armies are gathering on your borders, then you can attack. And in general, again, most in a government, most of the people who are there are not there by choice. Like, it's not like the people in Ukraine or Russia, they're all being grabbed off the streets and thrown into war, or they're shot. So they're more victims. But you would aim for the leaders, and you would aim to disable the leaders. So, all right. I wonder how right was Kaczynski, the Unabomber. How likely that with advances in tech society, we'll still be free? All the cameras, AI, social engineering, and such stuff. Well, there is that it's a huge problem, and I'll just touch on this briefly. I've talked about it before. One of the reasons why totalitarianism failed in the past was the amount of labor that it took to monitor and control and punish people was prodigious, right? You had to read people's letters. You had to, you know, keep a track of their history. There were these big files that were tough to transfer. With AI scanning of social media posts, you can automate the monitoring of people, and you can also automate their punishments, right? And so one of the big labor components of controlling people has been diminished. Now, of course, AI and cameras and all of this in a free society would virtually eliminate crime. I mean, basically, the only crime that still happens is the crime that the government wants to have happen. Because, I mean, if you've ever watched these true crime documentaries, it's like, well, he pinged off this cell tower, and then these five cameras caught the car in the neighborhood. And then we checked his social media history, and it turns out that there was a Word file that he planned this, that he deleted, but there was still a shadow file in the temp directory. Like, they can get you on just about anything now because everything's monitored, recorded, and people, you know, carry these monitoring devices of cell phones around with them and all. So they can get you pretty much. And so the only crime that really exists is crime that people want to exist. Or, of course, like the horrific 250,000 essays of children in England, that's because people were afraid of being called racist for all of that, which is wild. Like, racist becomes worse than, well, it's like racist, but with a P in the middle. It's just wild. So it is a problem. That's just one of the reasons I'm still in the fight for freedom. And, but you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. We hopefully can move towards using the communications technology to spread ideas of freedom and liberty, rather than, you know, if it gets handed over to the bad guys as it's drifting that way, then you will be, there's a reason why anti-free speech laws are being enacted, because then people can scan and find bad things and so on, right? So, all right, secular reasons not to cheat on your wife / husband. So the marital relationship, people think it's a line between the husband and the wife. And I'm just talking about procreative relationships, but which is really the point of marriage. So, I mean, the point of marriage is the protection of children. That's what marriage is. Other people can get married. Like, the point of a road is for cars to drive on. Doesn't mean you can't use a bicycle on them as well. But if you look at marriage as an inverted pyramid for the children, right? The children are the base. And it's the stability of the parents that provides the security for the children. So the reason why, so for secular reasons, you wouldn't cheat on your wife and husband is it harms your children. And you say, ah, but what if we don't have children? It's like, okay. So you make a vow and you make a promise. And who you are to other people is mostly your commitments. Like, who you are to other people is mostly your commitments. Like, if you say to your friend, I'm going to meet you at 7 o'clock, we're going to go and see a movie, then if you keep not showing up, he's not going to be your friend for very long, right? So who you show up for and your relationships. Relationships are based upon commitments. And so if you make the most solemn vow in your life, which is the vow to be faithful, to be monogamous and so on with your wife or your husband, that means who you are. We are our commitments. I mean, you're still listening and watching after I've been doing this for more than 20 years because I have a good commitment towards truth. I try to provide value with just about everything I say, and you assume or trust that I'm going to do that, and hopefully I am continuing to do that. So I am my commitments to virtue, my commitment to integrity, to honor, to courage, to monogamy, to, you know, my commitment to my child, my commitment to my audience. I am my commitments. If you shred your commitments, you dissolve your identity, you dissolve your personality. You just become a pleasure seeker. And then you put yourself, you try not to put yourself into situations where you have to lie. And of course, if you cheat, you are cheating on integrity, you're cheating on truth, you're cheating on honor. And it's also really terrible to have sex with your wife while cheating with another woman, or sex with your husband while cheating with another man, because it is a form of assault in that if she knew the truth, she wouldn't have sex with you. And so it's, in a sense, taking it. I'm not sort of legally, I'm not talking, but morally, if you lie to someone. And of course, you could spread diseases and so on, right? And so it's just bad for you. You set yourself against yourself. You end up having to lie and manipulate, which is going to shred your self-respect. And when people find out about it in a sane, rational society, you'd be ostracized and so on. So the temporary pleasure does not add up to the long-term decay in self-respect, in virtue, honor. I mean, you just can't have respect for yourself if you're lying to people you claim to love, having sex with a woman who'd never have sex with you if she knew the truth, and you are covering everything up. It just makes you into a furtive, surreptitious lowlife. And that's just going to be bad for your self-esteem all around. None of that involves God. So hopefully that makes sense. I would love to hear your thoughts on fear. I did that before. The truth about Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk was a horribly instructive blood sacrifice that, to me, the real death of Charlie Kirk came in the general forgiveness of his murderer. The left doesn't forgive. The left doesn't forgive. And they win. Forgiveness is surrendering the world to the bad guys. Again, I'm talking about forgiveness for things for which people can't make restitution. They can't earn your forgiveness, right? You can't bring Charlie Kirk back to life. So the fellow who shot him can't be forgiven because... So the real death of Charlie Kirk occurred to me. The physical death occurred, obviously, in that horrible stage. The real death of Charlie Kirk occurred when the Christians all ran bleating off a cliff to forgive his murderer, and that completely destroyed the outrage momentum that could have brought about real change. I'm not saying do everything the left does, but if your enemy is doing something that works, it needs to review it. Has the left forgiven me? I didn't even really do anything wrong. They haven't forgiven me. Did the left forgive Derek Chauvin? Did the left forgive the Jan Sixers? Did the left forgive, you name it, right? All of the people they've attacked and deplatformed and so on. I mean, the left hasn't even forgiven Joseph McCarthy, even though Joseph McCarthy was right. Has the left forgiven Franco? The left doesn't forgive, they escalate, and they win. And whether you like it or not, these are just facts. The people who forgive lose, and the people who don't forgive win. So in choosing to forgive Charlie Kirk's murderer, the conservative right in America is choosing to lose. And this is why I don't really do much politics anymore, because if people are addicted to the syrupy, smarmy self-satisfaction of pretending to be good by forgiving the unforgivable, then they're just going to lose. They're just going to lose. Left doesn't forgive. Left escalates. And forgiveness is on your knees for the sake of a reward in the afterlife, which isn't even real. There's nowhere in the Bible where somebody is forgiven without apologizing and making restitution and so on. So this modern forgiveness thing, I just think it's kind of like a psyop. It's like people promote the virtue of forgiveness so that they can get away with the unforgivable. All right. What is the distinction between UPB and Habermas and Appel's performative contradiction argument? Okay, so very briefly, this was in the late 1980s. A guy named Jürgen Habermas published a philosophical discourse of modernity. And sort of French post-structuralist thought was attacked by this. And so imagine these two formulations, right? So we'll say truth Anglo and truth French, right? Truth Anglo is what is accurate, factual, right? That's truth. Truth two is whatever I claim truth is. Truth is a social construction. Truth is subjective and so on. So you can't do truth French without accepting truth Anglo, right? So you can't say, oh, truth is whatever I claim truth is, because you are now making a truth statement, right? So truth is whatever I claim truth is, right? And we can see this all over the place, right? Truth is whatever I claim truth is. So truth is a social construction. Okay, is the fact that truth is a social construction also a social construction, or is it an absolute? Is it an absolute? So this is performative contradictions, or I've referred to them for decades as self-detonating arguments. So here's a way to explain it. A performative contradiction occurs when the act of making an argument undermines the very norms it claims to uphold, such as asserting universal validity while denying the possibility of rational agreement. Jürgen Habermas argues that postmodern relativism suffers from this contradiction because it relies on presuppositions of rational argumentation that it simultaneously denies. The following assertion from Michel Foucault is a shining illustration of this discrepancy. Quote, truth isn't outside power or lacking in power. Truth isn't the reward of free spirits, the child of protracted solitude, nor the privilege of those who have succeeded in liberating themselves. Truth is a thing of this world that is produced only by virtue of multiple forms of constraint, and it induces regular forms of power. It is produced and transmitted under the control, dominant, if not exclusive, of a few great political and economic apparatuses, university, army, writing, media, right? So, truth isn't outside power or lacking in power. Truth is produced and transmitted under the control of blah, 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 blah. So all truth is related to power. All truth is related to propaganda. All truth is control of others. And it's like, okay, so then that's true for you as well. Michel Foucault, right? So saying, I have the truth about truth, and the truth about truth is the truth is subjective, or the truth is a power mechanism, or the truth is a control mechanism. I have the objective truth that all truth is subjective. I have the objective truth that all truth is a social construct. I have a truth outside the social construct that all truth is a social construct. That is just a complete contradiction. That is the rantings of a crazy person. That's like screaming at someone, you do not exist, you do not exist, and so on, right? So truth is not that which is objectively and empirically and universally. There's no such thing. So is it true? Is it true that truth is subjective? It's a statement like everything is relative. Everything is subjective. Okay. Is it a subjective truth that everything is subjective? Or if you say truth is what you believe it is, and I say truth is not what you believe it is, truth is the relationship between ideas in the mind that claim to describe reality and reality itself, right? So if I say, this is a wad of paper, that is a true statement because the concept in my mind, the words that I'm using are accurate, that it is a stack of paper, a wad of paper. So the performative contradiction is if you say all truths are subjective, then the belief that truth is not subjective should be fine. If I believe that truth is objective, then nobody should disagree with me if they believe truth is subjective. Because I just have a belief that truth is objective, and my truth is as valid as your truth, that truth is subjective, because all truths are what you believe in, right? And so I hope this makes sense. However, whenever I'm around subjectivists, relativists, and so on, the postmodernists, and I say truth is rational and objective, they're like, no, it's not. Truth is subjective, relative, and power-based. It's like, but if all truth is subjective, who the living fuck are you to disagree with me when I say the truth is, truth is subjective to me, right? So they can't resist. Postmodernism is a way of dissolving virtue. because we need to have true statements about virtue that we wish to pursue. And so postmodernism is a way of dissolving virtue and making people easier to control, right? Because if you have standards of virtue outside of that which authority says to you, then you're a thorn in the side, a sand in the Vaseline, a irritant in the oyster of the will of power, right? The will of power wants to control and subjugate you. If you have standards of virtue and truth and ethics that are higher than what you're told to do, then you're willing to suffer negative consequences from those in power because you have a conscience that will make you suffer even worse if you go along with those in power. So you have a standard or virtue that interferes with the expansion of political power, like the trucker convoy. In Canada, the most successful modern resistance movement. So, of course, people who want to control you want to dissolve your sense of reality, objectivism, empiricism, virtues, and values. Of course, they don't want you to have standards of truth and virtue higher than the will and power of authority. So they will say that there's nothing true, there's nothing that's real, there's nothing that's valid, right, and so on, right? And so people, and you can say this, when people say there's no such thing as objective truth, then, or there's no such thing as objective virtue or objective values, then you can say, oh, then why is racism bad? And they'll short circuit, right? They'll short circuit. Or why is sexism bad? Or whatever, right, they believe is homophobia, whatever they believe is bad. If they say there's no such thing as truth, values, objective virtues, and so on, then it's like, well, then why are these things that you consider bad? Why are they bad? So if everyone's, like if someone says, preference for color is subjective, right? I like blue, you like green, somebody else likes cyan or whatever it is, ash gray, golden sunset. So if we're in a conversation and you say, I like the color green, and I say, oh, I like the color blue, right? He's not going to say, no, you're wrong. You're wrong. Because if he says all preferences for color are subjective, then for people having preferences for color, there should be no disagreement. So if everyone says all truth is subjective, then I say, well, my truth is that truth is objective. They should have no problem with that. It's just a different color that I like. But they tell me I'm wrong. Now, the moment someone tells you that you're wrong, they can't say that truth is subjective because they're correcting you. So that is the performative contradiction, the self-detonating argument on the left. It's blindingly obvious, and right, everyone who studies philosophy, even their teens, if somebody says nothing is true, say, is that a true statement? Okay, well, then something is true. And how did you come about the argument that nothing is true? And why haven't you even noticed that it's a manipulation and so on? So I hope that helps. Freedomain.com/donate. Thank you so much for these great, great questions. Call.freedomain.com to set up a call in with me. Summers are open because people call less in the summer. So if you want to do a public or private call, you can do that at call.freedomain.com. And again, freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Lots of love, my friends. Take care. Bye.